How about a round of applause for Dr. Shearhart for organizing this? So glad to see such a wonderful turnout. This is really a fascinating issue to explore, especially because it affects so much of us, whether you be a commuter by bike, by car, or just a student. We are all in ways stakeholders of alternative transportation. So to start off, I've got a few notes here so I can get my names right. So tonight's event is being sponsored by several campus and community groups, including the Texas State Honors College, the Texas State Common Experience, the Philosophy Dialogue Series, the Texas State Department of Geography, and the local alternative transit organization, Move San Marcos. We want to thank all of them for their support. Quick round of applause. So quick overview of tonight's event is we will have our kind of brief introduction. We heard from Peter a second ago, and then each of our panelists will give a few minutes about kind of their research and work and how that pertains to transit and alternative forms of transportation in San Marcos. After the discussion completes, we'll read some questions from the audience, and also if anybody feels inclined, you can come up on the mic and pose a question if it didn't get answered yet. We will be continuing the discussion with our panelists, which I will introduce right now. First, we have, all the way on my right, Dr. Billy Fields, who's an associate professor of political science at Texas State, and his research focuses on understanding the key elements of resilient communities. He has examined resiliency from transportation, urban planning, public health, and hazard mitigation perspectives with publications. He is also co-editor of the spring 2013 release by Island Press, Transport Beyond Oil. He also leads the Texas State Education Abroad trip to the Netherlands. Quick round for Dr. Billy Fields. We have Mr. Alex Vogt. I unfortunately don't have a bio for him, but he is the alternative transit coordinator. Is that correct?
Transportation
coordinator. And currently handles the shuttles, right? Your interim shuttle manager?
That's correct.
So that's a whole ordeal. He told me earlier he was all day out at the tailgate today trying to mitigate all that, which is something else. I'm sure you all know how the tailgate affects transportation and campus. On my right, we have Andrea Villalobos, senior city planner with the City of San Marcos. She's a graduate of the Honors College at Texas State and completed a degree in geography, urban and regional planning, and will be graduating with a Master of Public Administration this December. Andrea is a regular bike commuter in San Marcos and bikes for almost all daily needs. In her free time, she also does long-distance bike touring and bike camping throughout Texas and recently started mountain biking on the San Marcos trails. So now I'd like to invite our panelists to say a few words about transit in San Marcos. Let's start my far right with Dr. Billy Fields. I think he has a presentation for us.
Yeah, I do. Hope this is either a really good idea or a really bad idea, because I'm going to zoom out for a minute. We're going to talk a lot about San Marcos in a second. I'm going to zoom out and think about the issues of safety. I lead a program to the Netherlands. Anyone wants to go, you're welcome to join us next year. We have a graduate of our program here as well. It's really fun, and then you get to experience a place that has really taken a different path to transportation. What's interesting is people think of Amsterdam as a place that's always been bikes and always been safe. But in the 1970s, Amsterdam was actually not very safe and had about the same mode share of walking, biking, and driving as we do here. And they changed course. And so what I want to do is tell you a little bit about that changed course, what it could mean for Texas, and then we'll kick it over to talk a little bit more in depth about San Marcos. But I want to start off with an image. So I was out for a bike ride, and I see these signs all over the place, drive like your kids live here. I always wonder, what if we designed our streets like kids lived here? Because we need to, because my kid lives here, your kids may live here in the future or wherever they're going to be, but we need streets that are safe. And in the Netherlands, they've taken that not as a rhetorical question, but as an actual public policy to look at and how to improve their streets. So a little background. Unfortunately, there were 40,000 road fatalities in 2017. That was up from 30,000 fatalities in 2013. Imagine that there is a plane with 110 passengers that's crashing every third day. No survivors. It just happens over and over and over again, and we don't do anything about it. Why is that? And so I teach public policy, and I think about these things. And one of the things that seems to come to mind is that people don't think that there are policy options available. They think it's just the sort of price that we have to pay for the transportation system. And in studying transportation systems around the world, I found that it's not. You can get a high quality of life, you can get all the things that you want, and a safe transportation system. So how do you do that? How do you move from a Texas system where you have 13.1 traffic fatalities per 100,000 people to a Dutch system where you have 4 per 100,000? So what's interesting is the way that you do that is to think about a safe system. This a lot of times is talked about as Vision Zero, if you've ever heard that term thrown around. The goal is to have zero fatalities in your transportation system. The Dutch don't have zero fatalities in their transportation system, but they're a lot closer than we are. So how do they do that? And the most important thing is that humans make mistakes. We make mistakes. We have a transportation system, unfortunately, that doesn't allow you to make a mistake. The mistake can become fatal. And in large measure, that's because of speed. The faster people go, whether you're walking, biking, or in a car, the more sort of force you have. And then that causes greater fatalities and serious injuries. The image here talks about what the fatality chance is if you're going 20 miles an hour, and it's a 10% fatality risk, to 40 miles an hour, where it's an 80% fatality risk. So the sweet spot for urban areas is really thinking about getting those speeds lower, 30 miles an hour and lower. And that's really what you get when you do that, is you get a real difference in terms of fatality rates from the US to the Netherlands. I'm not saying that we can be the Netherlands tomorrow, but the Netherlands wasn't the Netherlands last week either. It took a long time to get there. And this push that that they've had to change their streets has been really successful. So how did they do that? They manage speed through residential streets, 30-kilometer streets, which is about 18-mile-an-hour streets. 75% of the streets in the Netherlands are now traffic calmed to this level, very successful. And then on higher speed streets, you need to separate pedestrians and cyclists. And you do that through sidewalks. Sidewalks are really good and an important part of how we build cities, or should be. And then cycle tracks. Cycle tracks provide a dedicated space for cyclists. And when you do that, it's really successful. So a couple of pictures to show you what this looks like. Here's a low stress neighborhood street in Delft in the Netherlands. And just to let you know that you don't have to be in the Netherlands to have that happen, here are a couple of examples. I was just out in Vancouver, and they take a North American framework to streets, and then they've redone them over the last 10 years and have seen incredible numbers of increases in bicycle mode share, the number of people bicycling, and improvements in safety. And it's doable. It's not rocket science. Here's a cycle track, what it looks like in Delft. And here is a cycle track of what it looks like in Vancouver. We could be doing this. It didn't look like this 3 years ago in Vancouver. And imagine the places that you see in San Marcos or Central Texas, we can make those changes. Finally, bike lanes. Bike lanes are used very sparingly in the Netherlands. In large measure, you don't want to mix traffic. This is one on a kind of residential street. It's a nice step forward, but really, if you have higher speeds, you need to be moving more towards cycle tracks. I'm a big bike lane advocate. We should be building them, but we should be thinking about where we build them and the traffic calming that's part of it. And then finally, I'm writing a book right now on the intersection of walking, biking, and green infrastructure. And really, you heard me introduced talking about disasters. I'm really interested in water and water management. Streets occupy about 30% of urban areas, with parking up to 50% of all urban areas are parking and streets. What if we re-envision those streets? This is a traffic circle in Copenhagen. Doesn't look like a traffic circle now. It was 2 years ago. Basically, they turned it into a little mini urban forest that then soaks up water, provides a place for families to go. And just around the corner of the picture is a really nice new cafe and bakery. They have really great baked goods in Copenhagen. I highly recommend it if you get there. But what it does is it creates livable communities, places that you want to be that are safe. And then here's another image in Copenhagen of a cycle track where you incorporate these green infrastructure features as well. And finally, an image from Vancouver that shows that you can do it in a North American context as well. What if we want to do it in Texas? Well, if we want to start tomorrow, one of the things that we can do is we can start taking spaces that don't have sidewalks and just painting them and putting them in. This is an example from Seattle. Basically, they took an area where there was a little extra excess capacity on the street. They painted in basically a cycle track, bike lane combination sidewalk. Here's an example from the Limitless Lane, in Fort Worth. It shows how simple paint can start to do the trick. I showed you some really amazing examples from around the world. We're not going to get there tomorrow, but we can start with approaches like this where we start to innovate, particularly in our neighborhoods, making our neighborhoods safe for everybody who lives there. There's a lot of demand for these type of places, and we could start building them even tomorrow with our paint out on the street. This all leads to bigger questions, right? So we want safe places where we can walk, bike, and take transit. And we also want to decrease our greenhouse gas emissions. Places, unfortunately, that don't do these type of things also are the places that have the highest greenhouse gas emissions and increases. Here is Portland, Oregon, where they've done the opposite. They've built safer streets and transit, and they decreased their greenhouse gas emissions. This is from the New York Times today, so I was just playing with it to give you a sense of how it works. You should use one of your free New York Times articles and go to this site. It's fantastic. But if you don't do this, what you end up with is like Austin, where you saw a 12% increase in per person emissions since 1990. We're headed the wrong way. If we start to build walkable, bikeable, transit accessible neighborhoods, we can flip the script. We can flip the script in the United States, and the examples from Vancouver and then from Europe show you how to do that. And most importantly, they create places you really want to be. They're exciting, they're fun, they have economies, they're vital. We could do this if we wanted to. So it really takes political will. And so we can do better if we want to, and it's really a policy choice about how to think about that. So that was quick, I went through a lot of information. And then what I was hoping to do, maybe we could transition and think about San Marcos and how we can take some of these sort of big ideas and plant them and have small seeds beginning to develop. So with that, I'll pass the mic over, thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Fields. It's a tough act to follow, but we'll do my best. So like Nick mentioned, my name's Alex Vogt. I'm the Alternative Transportation Coordinator at Texas State and the current interim shuttle manager. I manage our fleet of 48 transit buses, the on-campus bike share, all of the other alternative transportation programs on campus, such as Zipcar, the ride share carpool solution we have, which is My Commute Solutions. And last but not least, the university's Bike Cave, which is our on-campus bike shop where you can come learn how to work on your bike for free. And if you don't have a bike, we can also sell you one. So I think jumping in to the nitty-gritty, you know, in our office, we get a lot of requests on things that we should change about transportation at Texas State, but they're usually pretty superficial. They're not, you know, people are asking for more buses on a route or more parking at a building or, you know, those, which is not something that you can do quickly or honestly sometimes ever, because, you know, all of our resources are allocated. I think that, you know, what I would hope everyone takes away from this is that, you know, think there are innovative solutions that aren't being, you know, capitalized on everywhere, including this university. So if you're interested in something, really, you know, think about it, figure out make a thoughtful request, and then advocate for it. That's where I'm at.
Hi, I'm Andrea Villalobos. I am a senior city planner with the city of San Marcos. And so I'll talk today from the perspective of being a city planner and as a bike rider. I am new to bike riding. It's not something, I grew up in a rural area. I didn't have a place to ride a bike. I couldn't ride to get groceries. That just wasn't my environment. And I found a community of friends that I was able to start riding. I actually was going to go to a Texas Trails conference, and the people I was going with was like, hey, you want to ride to this conference to go learn about trails and how to plan for trails? And I was like, I cannot do that. I can't ride to Austin from San Marcos. And so I started to learn to ride. I got a bike, and I just slowly had friends and people who were able to teach me about riding, what it's like, the things to be aware of, sort of the infrastructure, and sort of that community is what helped me become a rider. And now I ride all the time. I chose where I live currently because I like to ride. So it's tough finding a place in an area where you can ride to places, and that, you know, I can talk about land use, and I'm sure there'll be questions about that, but I chose where I live for those reasons, and now I do it as sort of a recreation. And so from the planning perspective, so a city planner is, I guess we're kind of, we have to be experts in everything, I feel. So we're very multidisciplinary. We have to know about transportation, we have to know about land use, we have to know about public health and how that relates to everything. Understanding parking, understanding the market, landscaping, just really understanding a lot of different aspects. And I think in the conversation today, we'll see how so many different things of the built environment are very connected. And so there are a lot of sort of moving pieces to become a place like the Netherlands, or to become a place like a city that is also bikeable. That's a college town, but I think we can sort of get there. So that is me. Thanks.
All right, round of applause for our panelists so far. Thank you so much. All right, Dr. Sherrod has just given me our questions we have thus far. So I'm going to start reading some of these and kind of turn it over to our panelists to discuss those a little bit more, and then we'll see what happens from there. So from Josie, this is circled as a community issue. How can the public encourage decision makers / policymakers to develop transportation policy that puts people first? So whoever would like to take that on first.
So, policy is really driven a lot by you guys. So policy comes from boards and commissions and councils and elected officials. So elected officials, they listen to the community and they include initiatives and goals based off of what the community wants. Right now, one of the strategic initiatives that the council has is multimodal transportation. And so that is one of their strategic initiatives that they have set as one of their goals for this year. But I think pushing policy really comes from what you all want. And there are a lot of platforms and a lot of groups to join to be able to push that. So I think it really comes from the initiatives. And the Netherlands didn't turn into the Netherlands overnight. It was really wanting it and working hard to get there. So you guys are a big help in that.
And just to jump in, that issue of not having public input is not singular to the community, that being the city. So you can do that too at Texas State. You can ask for things that you want, but maybe not more parking.
So that was a great question. I'm actually writing the end of the book that I'm working on right now, and I'm struggling with that right now. Just to sort of to add on to what we said, what I'm really getting at, in the places that I've seen success, there have been movements that have developed based around safety. In the Netherlands, there was the Stop the Child Murder campaign. They're very direct in the Netherlands. They're like, no, we don't want kids killed in our streets. So they did that, and they created this movement in the 1970s to push that forward. In the U.S. right now, we have the Vision Zero movement, which is getting more popular and powerful. We also have your discussion about city planning and what city planners do is important. We also have a public health side of this, both in terms of safety and in terms of sort of active living and creating basically more movement in our communities. We also have sort of another side of this, which is we have an aging population that wants to age in place. And if we create communities where people can walk and bike and meet their own daily needs, then we do all of those things at the same time. And in the United States, 50% of all trips are 3 miles or less. So we're not talking about changing everything everywhere that people go, but it's those shorter trips that you have a real opportunity to hit with walking and biking. And then the transit connection is how you get to the sort of larger realm. And I drove down from Austin today, and that just kills me every time. Like, I study walking and biking, and I'm stuck on I-35. You could get rid of me off of I-35 really easily with a connection that linked down. And so those are the sort of things that I think about, but really it's about push. And there's an opportunity with multiple coalitions that are bubbling up now. Linking those coalitions can be powerful.
I think to kind of expand on this, here's another question we have from a student and staff member at Daniel. And I would pose this to you first, Billy. What do you argue is the first step in converting an unsafe traditional street into a more inviting, livable space? Is it slower speeds, increased public transit, education, or something like that? What do you think is a good jumping off point?
Traffic calming. And this is the component that can be popular and not popular at the same time. So traffic calming slows people down. And traditionally in the United States, it's done with speed bumps. No one likes speed bumps. So you drive and you're like, this is ridiculous. Why are there speed bumps? I should be going faster. And that, like, you would go faster without the speed bumps. But if you think more holistically about traffic calming, you can get things that you want for your neighborhood. One of the streets that we look at in Delft in the Netherlands was the first Voorner in the world, which is a traffic calm street that's sort of walking for kids. Kids can go out and walk on it. And what they've done is they put kind of green planters kind of in the street that makes you slowly move around them. And they've created this slow speed street with all sorts of places for people to hang out, to meet their neighbors, to soak up water when it rains. And what it does is it slows traffic at the same time. So if you think about multiple goals at the same time and how to get those goals happening and how to sell the green space at the same time that you're slowing the traffic, there's a chance for residential streets. But just putting in speed bumps, people don't see that. They don't see any benefit. They're like, why are you doing this? But if you sell it more holistically, I think there's a chance. And that's where you get the benefits in terms of safety.
Is there another possible example of like combining the speed bump with something else, like a raised crosswalk?
Yep. Yeah, you can do that. The Vancouver
example. The question real quick, is there another way of combining combining maybe a speed bump to make it a raised crosswalk or something? Yeah.
So the second thing, you've got the raised crosswalk, you've got this sort of green infrastructure, you can put them together. The examples that I saw in Vancouver recently had bioswales and raised crosswalks and all sorts of combinations of different things, and they were out pilot testing them. They had this one section of town where they closed off a street and they turned it into a public park. And it basically didn't allow cars to come through, but was this new green space for the community. And they put a piano out. And then it was right down the street from a home for older folks. And the older folks came out and played piano and they taught the kids how to play piano. It was great. You can do all those different type of things if you think about innovation and think about streets in a different way.